He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. You take a look at the FBI a year ago. It was in virtual turmoil less than a year ago. It hasn't recovered from that.
Donald Trump, in an interview with NBC Today, the firing of FBI Director James Comey is still dominating the news. And the story is changing fast. There was also a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing today where Comey's replacement, Andrew McCabe, testified. And here to distill it all down to the important points is McKay Coppins. He writes for The Atlantic. He's been covering the Comey fallout. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, in that NBC interview with the president, anchor Lester Holt asked him about his decision to fire Comey and the part in his letter to Comey where Donald Trump claims that Comey told him three times he wasn't under investigation. Let's listen.
Why did you put that in there?
Because he told me that. I mean, he told me
he
that.
He told you weren't under investigation
with regard to the Russia investigation? I've heard that from others.
Was it in a phone call? Did you meet face to face?
I had a dinner with him. He wanted to have dinner because he wanted to stay on. We had a very nice dinner at the White House very early on. A dinner was arranged. I think he asked for the dinner. And he wanted to stay on as the FBI head. And I said, I'll consider. We'll see what happens. But we had a very nice dinner. And at that time, he told me, you are not under investigation, which I knew anyway.
That was one meeting. First of all,
when you're under investigation, you're giving all sorts of documents and everything. I knew I wasn't under. And I heard it was stated at the committee, at some committee level, that I wasn't.
Okay, so he told Lester Holt that Comey had indeed told him he was not under investigation at a dinner and in two separate phone calls. And I'm wondering if that has been corroborated, whether Comey told him he wasn't under investigation, or is it basically Trump's word and we have to take him at his word?
Well, I don't know if we have to take him at his word, but that is, so far there has been no further corroboration of that. I can tell you that the sources that I've talked to, including people in the president's orbit and allies of the president, found it bizarre and maybe misguided to put in the letter a reference to the Russia investigation and to say the way that President Trump did in that letter firing Comey, that he had been told on three separate occasions he wasn't under investigation. If nothing else, it drew attention to Trump's possible motives here in, as critics have said, possibly impeding the investigation. But beyond that, it opens him up to the possibility that Comey, who very likely will end up speaking on this, whether by subpoena or of his own free will during a testimony or a hearing, it opens him up to contradicting what the president has said. So we don't know at this point whether it's actually true if Comey told Trump that he was not under investigation, but the president is sticking to that line at this point.
Yeah, because Lester Holt further questioned him and said, well, Comey has testified that indeed the campaign is under investigation and you were the center of that campaign. And then the president then said, yes, but I'm not personally under investigation.
That's right, which is interesting parsing. There's another interesting contradiction that we saw today with acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe's testimony on Capitol Hill, where he contradicted what the White House has been saying, which is yesterday the deputy press secretary at the White House said that the Russia investigation was, quote, probably one of the smallest things on the FBI's plate. Andrew McCabe directly contradicted that and said that in his view and in the view of the FBI, this was a highly significant investigation. So we're already seeing the White House's lines kind of fall apart under scrutiny, and the FBI is being positioned in direct opposition to the White House's own message that they're trying to put forward.
Okay, here's another story that seems to have changed. In that interview, as we said, Trump said he wanted to fire Comey before he received the memo from the Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. Yesterday, the spokeswoman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, said quite the opposite. And in fact, many people from the White House were saying the opposite, that it came from the Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, and the Deputy Attorney General, I should say. Let me just play an exchange she had today with CNN's Jonathan Karl.
Now we learn from the president directly that he had already decided to fire James Comey. So why were so many people giving answers that just weren't correct? Were you guys in the dark? Was the vice president misled again, as happened?
I know you'd love to report that we were misled, and we want to create.
That weren't true.
Hold on, Jonathan. I let you finish and read off every single one of those statements. So, unless you want to trade places, I think it's my turn now. I think it's pretty simple. I hadn't had a chance to have the conversation directly with the president to say. I'd had several conversations with him, but I didn't ask that question directly. Had you already made that?
Okay, and then she went on to say that the Democrats are the ones who are in the dark because they, many of them, had wanted James Comey fired in the first place. But Donald Trump's letter to James Comey said in it, in black and white, on paper, that he accepted the recommendation of the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. So, and then we're hearing also that Rosenstein threatened to resign over that. What's happening?
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, this is an important thing to bring up. The White House's line up until basically that interview with President Trump has been that the reason that the president in firing James Comey was acting on the recommendation of the Deputy Attorney General. Rod Rosenstein is widely respected in Washington in legal circles. He's viewed as a man who's not compromised by partisanship and is viewed as somebody who has integrity. The White House obviously thought at first that it was in their best interest to say that this was that they were acting on a recommendation from this person who has stellar credentials and a good reputation. Now to see President Trump come out and contradict that and say, no, I was going to fire him anyway, it raises the question why. It's possible, as Sarah Sanders said, that she and other White House aides were simply kept in the dark. I can tell you that based on my reporting and the reporting of my colleagues here at The Atlantic, it is certainly true that most of the people in the White House were blindsided by this decision to fire James Comey. And the last 24, 36 hours have been kind of a scramble to catch up. It's also possible, though, that Rod Rosenstein simply raised a fuss. We saw reporting that he threatened to resign over this. He then walked it back a little publicly and said he did not threaten to resign. But we've seen reporting that he made it clear he could not continue to work in an environment where all of the heat of this decision was falling on him. And so it's possible that President Trump and his advisors saw the writing on the wall, realized what could happen and how bad it would look if their deputy attorney general were to resign, and decided to take some of that heat off him. But it certainly, I think it's fair to say, it raises more questions than it answers.
So is it fair to say that it's pretty chaotic on this day two following the...
Can you tell from the way I'm trying to answer these questions? Yes, it is very chaotic. No, I mean, look, we're all trying to... There are a lot of questions that remain unanswered. The big one is, why did President Trump fire James Comey? Because the rationale that they've put forward, there have been three different versions of the story at this point. We don't know what the timeline was that led up to it. And we can tell you that the fundamental rationale is suspect. Donald Trump says that the White House has been saying that there was this crisis of confidence in the FBI under James Comey. Well, we saw Andrew McCabe, the acting FBI director, testify today under oath that simply isn't true, that Comey enjoyed the confidence of officials throughout the FBI, and that he was widely respected. We also know that polls suggest, as recently as a couple months ago, one poll found that 80% of Americans have trust in the FBI. So the idea that firing James Comey was this effort to restore public trust and confidence in the Bureau is suspicious, to say the least. Certainly, obviously, what critics are saying is that this had to do with trying to impede the Russia investigation. We don't know if that's the case. We don't have proof of that, but certainly that is the direction that I think the story is headed, and we'll hear a lot more about that in the days to come.
McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, let's hear more now about the FBI and play that clip of tape that McKay mentioned. This is Andrew McCabe speaking today at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing.
I can tell you that I hold Director Comey in the absolute highest regard. I have the highest respect for his considerable abilities and his integrity. And it has been the greatest privilege and honor of my professional life to work with him. I can tell you also that Director Comey enjoyed broad support within the FBI.
Okay, so that is a direct contradiction to what the White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said when she said that FBI agents had lost confidence in Comey. So what does this mean for the FBI's investigation into the Russian meddling in the election? And what could it mean for the relationship between the agency and the White House? Tim Weiner is here now. He's author of the book Enemies, A History of the FBI, also former New York Times correspondent who covered national security. Welcome.
Hello.
All right. You have spoken with current and former FBI agents. What are they telling you?
There is an admixture of anger and fear. There is also a resolute feeling that this action by the president was an attack on the institution of the FBI, not merely a decapitation of its director, and that they will redouble their energies in the investigation of the Russia hacks and the connection of the Trump campaign to that attack.
So they will redouble their efforts. But as we have heard, James Comey had asked for more resources from the Justice Department, whether that's money or manpower, I don't know. But what if they are not given additional resources? Can they indeed redouble their investigation?
They will have to work harder, and they will.
And so, but what if they're redirected by an incoming FBI director onto other projects and other investigations?
Can we drop the pretense that this is about Hillary Clinton's emails or a crisis of confidence in the FBI? This is the President of the United States feeling the hot breath of the FBI's bloodhounds closing in on the White House. And there is a strong case to be made, although it is circumstantial, that what Donald Trump did was to impede that investigation. And if so, that could be seen by a court or by the Congress in days to come as an obstruction of justice.
So firing James Comey being the obstruction of justice, you're saying?
An attempt.
An attempt at obstruction of justice.
Yes.
So what does that mean in terms of who he might nominate to run the FBI now?
Well, the number of people who are A, acceptable to Donald Trump, B, confirmable by the Senate, and C, qualified to do the job is vanishingly small.
And any names come to mind? They're floating Mike Rogers.
The former congressman?
From Michigan, yeah.
I would not place a strong bet on his being confirmed by the Senate.
Hmm.
It's possible. Anything's possible. We've seen a lot of 51 to 49 and even 50 to 50 confirmations in the Senate in the first months of the Trump administration. But he would have quite a task ahead of him.
And what is that task? Can you outline it? What does the new director need to do to restore confidence within and without the organization?
Where was the confidence shaken?
Well, since the firing of James Comey.
Okay. To vow to uphold the rule of law and the Constitution of the United States. Nothing more. That's the oath of office. The president takes it. The FBI director is duty-bound to uphold the rule of law. And let's keep our eye on the ball here, what this case is about. This case is about an attack on the fundamental structures of American political democracy. We know that took place. The next question is, did Americans aid or abet that attack? And there are subpoenas going out to the former National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, and to his associates this week that are beginning attempts to address that question. This is a very serious matter. This is the most politically charged counterintelligence investigation the FBI has undertaken since the Soviets stole the secrets of the atomic bomb.
Mm. Well, I guess I'm wondering if the FBI can be confident, if the American public can be confident, I should say, that the FBI going forward, without James Comey and with an as yet unnamed leader, will pursue that as doggedly as apparently the FBI had been pursuing it until now?
I don't think there's any question that they will. Look, the FBI has gone up against the White House before. It went up against Richard Nixon, and it took Richard Nixon down. It went up against Ronald Reagan's national security team, and it helped bring indictments for the sale of weapons to Iran and the skimming of profits for the Contras in Central America. It went up against Bill Clinton, and with the White House physician in attendance, drew blood from Bill Clinton's arm to prove a DNA match with the infamous blue dress.
Mm-hmm.
This is about the rule of law, not about a political struggle between an individual director and a president.
As you said, the many of the agents are angry or disillusioned. They're not feeling too great after this firing of their leader, James Comey. Would they do anything to make Trump's life harder now? Any sort of payback, like, such as leaking documents?
Well, that's the stuff of fiction and, movies and TV that an FBI agent would say, how can I get the president of the United States? Nobody thinks like that. Nobody acts like that in real life. Real life is outstripping the capacity of fiction to invent interesting stories at this point. The White House is under investigation by the FBI. For the FBI to quail or somehow turn tail or tremble in fear and recoil at that mission is inconceivable.
Tim Weiner, he's author of the book Enemies, A History of the FBI. And by the way, he'll be at the Los Angeles Public Library next month to talk about this very issue, the FBI and Donald Trump. Tim, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand with the news out of Washington over the last 48 hours. The presidential election in France earlier in the week was forgotten pretty quickly, but the Russians are suspected of interfering in that election, too. The campaign of the most tough-on-Russia candidate, now president-elect Emmanuel Macron, was hacked, but Macron's technology team saw it coming, and they launched a counteroffensive. Tons of fake documents and emails that overwhelmed the hacker's ability to select the juiciest ones. Well, Shani Jordan is here now because it's Thursday and she's here every Thursday to talk about this kind of stuff, the tech and web stuff. Hi.
It's the season of the Internet Witch. It's Thursday.
Hey, embrace your identity.
I there's crazy stuff happening on the Internet and it's a day that ends in Y.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about this. It's called cyber blurring. There's actually a name for it. And what does it entail exactly?
Well, imagine you're a bank teller and you think that there's a good possibility you're going to get robbed in a holdup. And you salt the cash drawer with a bunch of fake bills and with the real bills. That would be a clever hack. Right. So that's kind of what they did. That's kind of what Emmanuel Macron's digital team did. He actually number one, he had a digital team that was mm-hmm. concerned about attempts by a foreign government, specifically Russia, to swing the election in favor of their openly supported candidate,
also
Marine Le Pen.
Also warned by the NSA.
Warned by our own National Security Agency. And it's so interesting. A year or so ago, we were talking about the Edward Snowden leaks and all of the dirty doings of the NSA at home. And boy, have times changed. Yeah. Like, I never thought I'd be, should we be launching a Patreon for the FBI now? Like, but at any rate, so the French were smarter than we were.
They also
they knew
saw
this
what
was
happened.
Coming. They
though.
Saw what they
had. They had their election first. Maybe they would not have seen it.
I'm not saying French people are smarter than Americans, but I'm saying hindsight is 20/20, and they got to look at our behinds. You know, this is a big loss for Vladimir Putin. So they had their victory lap yesterday in our White House with Lavrov and Kislyak and Putin in his hockey costume in Sochi, all gloating
Why
about
does
how
he
they
always win his hockey games.
Hey,
he must be a really great player. But anyway,
you could hate,
I digress.
you got to respect the man's got game, right? Game recognized game. But it's not a game that the French were about to lose at. So they still were subject to attack. And just yesterday, amid all of these crazy Comey headlines that were coming out hour after hour, what a news day yesterday was, there was also this news that the French news media online was under attack, that there was, again, this is credited to Russia, that there was a kind of denial of service attacks against French news websites. But they saw this coming. It's clear that this is seen as a big cyber war loss for Russia.
So describe salting the cash drawer.
Yeah.
What were the fake documents that they created?
Yeah, so they basically, some of the documents included emails or different kinds of official, you know, reports or meeting notes, all the sorts of things that one might imagine were also on the Democratic National Committee servers or, you know, John Podesta's risotto recipe. I don't know too much about the specifics, but the point was some of these were released as real documents by the hackers.
So instead of saying, okay, we're going to try to prevent the hack in the first place because
yes,
that's impossible, they said, okay, we're just going to overwhelm the hackers with all this information. And so they won't be able to get out any of the potentially damaging stuff in time to sway the election.
It really is brilliant. If you know that you're outgunned by superior firepower, what kind of tactics do you use? And they chose a tactic that a lesser cyber power could credibly bet the ranch on, and they won. So it's interesting to me to wonder, what's ahead for us here in the U.S.? There were hearings today at which our nation's continued vulnerability to Russian cyber attacks was discussed soberly. You know, it worked. There's no reason to think that Russia is going to stop being Russia in terms of their desire to exert power on the global stage. So they won this round of chess in the U.S. They lost it in France. Game not over.
Okay, let's move on to Snap, the local company behind Snapchat. And it's not making much money. It went public in March, and now it's lost a bunch of money since then. Maybe it's just never made money.
Yeah, Snapchat is one of these companies. Hey, like Facebook, there were times when we were wondering if Facebook was going to survive another year. And Twitter. These are the unicorns of Silicon Valley, and Snapchat is considered one of those long bets that made a lot of people very, very rich and continues to. The revenue and profit numbers fell below expectations. First quarter revenue of $149.6 million, so almost $150 million, missed the analyst expectations of $158 million. So to us, this sounds like a rounding error, but it's a big deal for investors.
Because they lost a lot more than they made.
$2.2 billion. They lost $2.2 billion. Billion. Yeah.
So do they not have a plan to make money, or what's happening?
Yeah. So it's much of that billion was actually tied to the employees' stock compensation. So it's not actually cash that they're leaving the building today, but it's more than the company has ever made. So we don't know exactly what's next. What we do know, what I know, is so Facebook is rumored to be about to turn on a new kind of monetization for video content creators. If you think about the dynamics of YouTube, where you have, here in LA especially, a lot of really talented young creators who've been just working so hard to put out content that YouTube tells them is going to work well on YouTube and make them and YouTube money. Well, they're seeing big revenue losses at YouTube, these talented creators. And Facebook is basically waving a flag saying, come hither, we're about to start paying you better money. How Snapchat fits into that mix when, you know, Facebook, I think, really dominates in terms of network size. Can Snapchat expand to cover new territory and bring in new users who are not yet users in the same way that Facebook and Instagram and that whole universe has the ability to bring people in because they're just so huge?
Yeah, and figure out the advertising, I suppose.
Figure out the advertising.
That's key.
Yeah,
without turning off their users.
Got to figure out the money. I don't know that Snapchat has figured out the money. But you know what? There are a lot of cool, smart people working at Snapchat. A couple of them are friends that I've known since the early hacker days when, you know, Friendster was just a twinkle in mom's eye.
Friendster.
Remember that? Yeah.
That's like Neolithic.
Make them feel old, woman.
Friendster.
I am old in internet years. It's true.
Shani Jardin is our Friendster. She's also co-editor of boingboing.net.
Like
you. I like you.
I like you too. I'm going to fave you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and here's a little taste of L.A. theater.
You boys, my young men, you are dying of someone else's sickness. Your lungs fill with blood, and you die. Have you ever once considered why?
God's will.
What sort of God takes boys away a decade before their prime of life? What have you ever done? What great and terrible sin did you ever commit?
One time.
Not now!
That was from Rajiv Joseph's latest play. It's called Archduke, now performing at the Mark Taper Forum. It follows three men with tuberculosis and nothing left to lose. And so they kill the Archduke Ferdinand and thereby start World War I. I promise it sounds grimmer than it is. It's actually really funny. And you may remember Rajiv Joseph's previous play, Bengal Tiger, at the Baghdad Zoo. It made it to Broadway back in 2010, starring Robin Williams. It was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now Rajiv Joseph is here now in the studio with me. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Okay, it has been, what, more than 100 years since World War I?
Yeah.
There have been countless books, movies, even video games about it. Why did you want to make a play?
Well, I was writing a different play altogether that had to do with composers. I was interested in classical music composers of two different eras, one of like the 19th century and one in the 20th century. And I was thinking about that passage of time, or that maybe the membrane between the two centuries, right? Not necessarily going from 1899 to 1900, but thinking about when did the 19th century become the 20th century? And I started thinking, well, it's probably World War I. Like, when we started that war, when that war began, it was still the 19th century. And then through the transformation of that cataclysm, the 20th century emerges. So I started thinking, well, maybe every century is like a person where it takes about 18 years for it to understand what it is. And if that's the case, that's where we are right now. And so, or about to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if by writing about that time period and that place, Serbia, in 1914, I could explore a cultural and political moment that we're experiencing right now. And so then I kind of let go of the two composers and started thinking about the actual events of these young assassins, because the more research I did about them, the more interesting they became to me.
It is so interesting. And when we think about the Archduke Ferdinand and his assassination, we always think of just one assassin, but in fact it was this band.
Yeah, well, there were eight young assassins in Sarajevo that day. My play focuses on three of them, including Gavrilo Princip, the young man who shot the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife Sophie.
And he is 18, yeah?
He was 19 when he did it, yeah.
So he does embody your thesis then?
Apparently, yeah. I mean, I'm also interested in those, you know, in young men, in terms of how their minds work and how their minds are sort of in some ways overactive, in some ways malnourished. And so I was interested, especially in regards to this story, how these young men might be manipulated and made to do something that they wouldn't normally do.
Mm.
Kill a man, kill themselves, or at least attempt to kill themselves. These young men, they all had tuberculosis, which at the time was more or less a death sentence for someone of their status and place in the world.
And they're like lower class.
Yeah, yeah. Peasants. They did not have money. And they were recruited by this organization called the Black Hand to carry out this terrorist event.
So all of this sounds very serious. And of course, in real life, it was extremely serious. And yet, your play is a comedy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that comes from, in many ways, the actual events. When I went to Sarajevo this past fall with the director of the play, Giovanna Sardelli, who's a good friend of mine, we went to research the play, and we went on the so-called assassination tour with this young man who kind of took us point by point through the entire day of that assassination. And he kept on using the word farce, because it really is, it's crazy the way these things happened. These young men were kind of bumbling idiots. The first young man tried to throw a bomb at the car. It bounced off the car and blew up the wrong car. He tried to take his cyanide. It wouldn't work. So he jumped in the river, which was 1 inch deep. So he broke his legs. And it's just everything that could go wrong went wrong. And yet somehow they still managed to assassinate this guy. And so the idea of the farce was always kind of present when you read the details of that day. And it's also kind of also the way I write. I tend to tackle, you know, subjects that, on when you just speak about them, what they're about, seem very dark and dreadful. But I'm one that thinks that, you know, when you're watching a piece of theater, especially about, you know, deeper and darker stuff, you need comedy to kind of push you through that. And my attempt is always to find the humor not in those events, but in the people, in the desires and in the peccadillos of these young men and why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and of course, when you think of what started the Iraq War, that's farcical too.
Yeah.
The yellow cake uranium that didn't exist, the reliance on this guy who was making up lies and convincing world leaders that he was telling the truth.
Right. I mean, it always feels that, like, gigantic global conflicts or, you know, situations start with any number of confusing details or mistakes or miscommunications, and that's kind of the basis of farce too. It's just that it happens to, you know, it happens to be deadly serious, but when looked at through the lens of theater, I think you have the opportunity to explore that in a different way. Cinema as well. I mean, I thought a lot about writing this play about Dr. Strangelove, which is a very, very funny movie about, you know,
the end of the world.
Yeah, the end of the world. And so that was a guiding kind of force for me, as well as stuff like Laurel and Hardy and The Three Stooges, which I think you kind of see some of that in Archduke as well. You see these three young men who there's a physical comedy to it, you know, in their mistakes and in their fears and in the things they want desperately, like sandwiches and women.
Sandwiches and women.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're obsessed with sandwiches and women.
Yeah.
I get the women part, but the sandwiches?
I mean, have you ever been really, really hungry? I mean,
it's... But why a sandwich of all things?
Well, a couple of reasons. I mean, it's part of the story. Gavrilo, so after his associate blew up the wrong car, the Archduke and Sophie took off. They escaped what they thought was the one terrorist act of the day and went to the mayor's house. So Gavrilo Princi, thinking that the entire mission had failed, went to go get a sandwich. And he was eating a sandwich at a little shop right off the Apple Quay, when the Archduke wanted to go back and visit his wounded friends who had been blown up in that other car. They hadn't been killed, but they were taken to the hospital. So the Archduke and Sophie, the Duchess, come back. The car takes a wrong turn and stalls right in front of Gavrilo Princip, who's eating a sandwich. He puts the sandwich down, he draws his gun, and he starts World War I.
But of course, it wasn't just the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand.
No, and what it was the world was a powder keg. And if it hadn't been that, most likely it would have been something else.
Yeah.
A lot of people wanted war.
Except these three didn't really care. They didn't really understand what they were doing. Did they ever have an idea in real life?
Yeah, I think in real life they were more politically... They had a sharper political acumen. Gavrilo had been a sort of radicalized young man for a while, it seemed, at least according to his testimony. He had tried to get into the military, and he couldn't get in because he was too small and frail. But in my telling of it, in Archduke the play, I take the tact of them being a little more innocent, because that's how I wanted to explore it. Because you read about these guys, and it's very dry in the history books. It's very kind of cut and dry, and even their statements, they seem to me blustery. Mm-hmm. They seem to me like They sound like they know what they're talking about, but like most teenagers don't know what the hell they're talking about, you know? And I think that there was a lot of bluster to that, a lot of posturing. And so I was taking the tact. I was working under the assumption that maybe these kids weren't radicalized terrorists from the age of five, but were actually scared, sick young men who were desperate for meaning.
Which is what we see today.
Exactly.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Rajiv Joseph. He has written a new play. It's called Archduke, and it's up at the Mark Taper Forum downtown. And I'm interested also in your depiction of masculinity, because there's another character who is recruiting these young men, and he is incredibly masculine and very sure of himself and what he's doing. And at the same time, there is also this constant refrain, this obsession with women, the lack of women in the lives of these young men, but also the woman in Gavrilo's head, mm-hmm. this imaginary woman that he conjures up telling him to do the right thing.
Captain Dragutin Dmitrievich was the...
I'm glad you said it. I didn't want to say his name.
The leader who recruited these young men. And when you read about him, there's scant personal information about him. But amongst that is that he never married and never had any interest in women, was only interested in being around men. And the book I read called Sleepwalkers, which is a wonderful account of World War I, says the same thing about the young men. Now, whether or not that's true or not, you can't really. It's really impossible to know. There are certain accounts of these people, but I thought it was a really interesting detail that was mentioned, that the men and the boys had no interest in women. They weren't gay, he says, but they weren't interested in women at all. And I was like, that doesn't sound like anyone in the world ever. So I was really interested in the presence of feminine power amongst these boys and men who, again, are posturing, are scared and angry and trying to assert themselves in the world. And we were in the middle of a workshop when in Los Angeles for this play, working on it, developing it, during the election. I was in L.A. for the election, and we left rehearsal one day and came back the next day, and the whole play had sort of shifted in a weird way because the world had changed so dramatically with the election of Trump. And I was someone who started thinking a lot about how I perceived the hatred for Hillary and how that manifested itself, how it manifests itself as a sort of cultural identity right now in the world. And it seemed to connect to this. And I think that in many ways, this young man, Gavrilo, in my play becomes obsessed with the skeleton of a woman that he finds in the doctor's office. The doctor tells him that the skeleton belonged to a woman, not a man, and this changes everything.
Doc, what? Is a man here once upon a time?
It's a woman.
What? The skeleton belongs to a female.
How's that a thing?
It happened.
I don't want to know that.
Everyone has bones.
You got a woman hanging off a hook? How's that proper?
It's science.
Wait,
if it was a man, that makes sense. It's a man's bones. But the fact that a woman has bones is fascinating to him. And he says that this woman who he gives a name, he calls her Dubravka because he thinks that she should have a name, kind of nestles in his consciousness. And it becomes the job of Apis, or Captain Dragutin Dmitrievich, to excise that feminine presence in this boy's head so that the boy is freed to go about the business of assassinating the Archduke. And so I found that to be a really compelling subtext and compelling kind of deeper idea to this, where this is not just about a history lesson, because it's not. My play is not a history lesson. But it is an exploration of these ideas of masculinity and femininity in the world and how and why a man and young men might rest free of that feminine part of themselves to tackle this.
So that skeleton of that woman that he invents, that's him.
Yeah, it's him.
It's the other side of him.
The part of him that's introspective. The part of him that thinks about the world in a more complicated and less black and white sort of approach that the captain is urging him to take on, because it's the black and white world of this is what's right and this is what's wrong, and here's where we stand on this side of this line, and here's where we stand on this side of this wall. That sort of thinking, that rigidity, is to me what leads to global conflict and what leads away from diplomacy.
Well, it's been so much fun. Thank you for coming in today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Madeline.
That's Rajiv Joseph. His new play, Archduke, is now up at the Mark Taper Forum. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Across the pond, a new museum exhibition depicts California as a place where hackers and hippies came together to design the future of personal liberation.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
Apple's iconic 1984 ad for the first Mac. The new show at the London Design Museum is called California Designing Freedom. And one of the curators of that show, Justin McGurk, is here with us now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, your exhibition, I understand, centers around the idea that California design is all about personal freedom. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we do is we take a particular slice through Californian design, which is about this idea of tools of personal liberation. So I wouldn't say that all Californian design is about freedom, but what we're looking at particularly is the design culture around personal computers and smartphones and Silicon Valley generally, and tracing the roots of that design culture to an ethos that was very common in the 1960s among the counterculture, of this idea that, you know, tools should liberate people, people should be free to live how they want, they should be self-sufficient. And so it's a show about California design from the 60s to now, but particularly this idea of tools of personal liberation.
So, example, what is a tool of personal liberation?
Well, I mean, Apple would say that an iPhone is a tool of personal liberation because you can do, you know, almost anything you want, almost anywhere, just with this one little device. So in theory, the very kind of mobility of it frees you up to do, to work, to play, to entertain yourself, all from this tiny little screen that fits in your pocket almost anywhere, and particularly to connect with as many people as, you know, as you can. So that's a tool of personal liberation in a way.
You could argue that's a tool of personal enslavement.
Very much so, yes. I think you know, this is a kind of growing view of the tools that Silicon Valley produces. And when we call the show California Designing Freedom, we don't do it in a kind of unknowing, you know, hand-clapping kind of way. We are kind of, we're raising the question. And there's a kind of little bit of ambiguity there. But I think that what we're really saying is that, you know, there are these overtones of Silicon Valley today which suggest enslavement or to our technology, or even darker things like surveillance. But those aren't the impulses that lead to the creation of these tools. There's one key impulse that drives design and innovation in California, we find, and certainly lots of other writers and thinkers have found, and that is this idea that tools should be made available to all. So the personal computer is the quintessential example of this. The computer used to belong to the military and to kind of corporations, and they filled up whole rooms. And there was a very kind of slow process by which those computers were made available to individuals. And they would, you know, it was a very West Coast idea that the computer could be a tool of personal liberation. You know, on the East Coast, it was still seen as a kind of tool of business.
Mm. What about the actual physical design, the Mac happy face, all the stuff that we're seeing on Snapchat, for example, when you can vomit rainbows, things like that. You know, all of that. I think there's a section in your exhibition where you link some of that design ethos to taking acid, LSD.
Well, acid is a presence in the show. I think, you know, the hippies and the counterculture in the 1960s, there were two things going on. You know, they were dropping out and going to live in communes, and they were, you know, needing their own tools, And so they were using this catalog, the Whole Earth catalog, to find their tools. But acid was also a tool. It was a tool of perception, if you like, or a tool of expanding consciousness. And, you know, several of the key figures who ended up becoming super important to computer culture were proponents of taking LSD. Steve Jobs, for example, took LSD. One of the key figures, Douglas Engelbart, who invented the mouse, he invented hyperlinks, he invented, you know, the whole idea that different people could collaborate on a single document. He was a proponent of LSD. There is that. But it's not, I mean, we don't want to overplay the role of LSD. I mean, I think what you just described, this whole new world of icons and emojis, that's a new graphic language that has come out of computer culture. And it has roots, you know. So we put in the exhibition, we have the original notebook that Susan Kerr drew the icons for the Apple Macintosh in. And, you know, these things that we take for granted, like trash cans and folders and cursors, somebody drew them on a piece of squared paper, and they took on a life that became totally familiar to us. We now, you know, the way we use our computers now is so intuitive, this idea of the desktop, but somebody had to invent that.
Yeah. Okay, so this is taking place in London. It's a long way from here. And I'm wondering what kind of perspective you might have on our culture that perhaps we don't see because we're just enmeshed in it.
That's a great question. I mean, the first thing to say is I would say that the pervasiveness of these tools, by which I mean, you know, laptops, smartphones, social media, Facebook, Google, Twitter, I could go on, Apple, the pervasiveness of these tools have, and globally, have led to certain kinds of behavior, you know, which have become a kind of global behavior, whether it's, you know, sharing your life on social networks, taking selfies, using emoji, all of this stuff, in a way is a kind of global Californian culture. That's kind of what we're suggesting, is that in some way we're all becoming a little bit Californian. This idea that the individual matters, that the individual needs to express him or herself, be its truest version, share it, live it. You know, these kind of, in a way, quintessentially West Coast, it's kind of the liberation of the individual and the kind of expressiveness of the individual. It's quite a kind of West Coast idea.
All right. Well, thank you for illuminating ourselves to ourselves. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Justin McGurk. He's chief curator at the London Design Museum. The show California Design opens there May 24th. Of course, you'll have to go over to London to see it. Oh, well.